You're listening to the fourth and final part of Unexplained, Season 7, Episode 18, A Dance with Mr. D. John D. stood by the barge's rail as it drifted slowly around a bend in the River Thames, soaking up a last, lingering view of his beloved Mortlake house and library. It was late September 1583, and Dee, along with his wife Jane and their children, and his scryer Edward Kelly and his wife Joanna, was on his way to Europe. It was hard to leave his home, and it wasn't just the books, rare artifacts, and laboratory equipment he had to leave behind. The home contained significant and treasured memories. It was where his children were born. The Queen had visited him there, and it was where his mother had died. But more important than any of that, it was where he and Edward Kelly communed with angels, and they were on a roll. Stopping now risked ruining all hope of completing his investigation of the angels' Enochian language and unlocking the secrets of the universe. For all he knew, leaving Mortlake could mean severing all contact with the other side. But in the end, Dee felt he had no choice, and Kelly was quick to reassure him that all would be well. Only a few months before, Dee and Kelly delivered news from the angels to Polish Prince Albert Laski that he would soon be crowned King of Poland. Shortly after that, Dee received the dire warning from the spirit child Madimi that his life was in immediate danger. After telling Prince Laski all about it, the prince, still glowing from his own more optimistic prophecy, proposed a solution. Dee should return with him to Poland, where he would look after him for the foreseeable future. And so, one night, under cover of darkness, Dee and the rest of his group took off from Mortlake with the prince. They sailed through all of London, past its many mullioned windows, the Tower of London, and under the narrow arches of London Bridge, piled high with houses. The smell of smoke from chimneys drifted over the river, and sounds of laughter spilled from taverns before fading as the boat slipped away downstream. As night blended into dawn and a dull red sun rose up over the horizon, they arrived at the coast. From there, the travellers boarded a faster vessel and set off in light winds towards the Low Countries of Europe. But the gentle weather didn't hold. By midnight, it had become so stormy, their boat was driven back to England. Forced to abandon ship, Dee slipped and fell into the deep, stinking estuarine mud as he and the others made their way to shore. Like the players in an ill-fated Shakespearean drama, they waited 4 days for the storm to die down before reboarding the ship. On September 28th, they finally reached mainland Europe, where they promptly hired wagons and set off for Poland, all safe and sound. For now. John Dee's travelling party, minus Prince Laski, who had business to attend to elsewhere, made torturously slow progress across Europe. But Dee was happy. Despite leaving England, the communications with the angels continued unabated. Most nights, as they trekked deeper into the continent, Dee and Kelly consulted the spiritual beings. Some of Kelly's apparent visions were disturbing, however, including predictions that Dee's Mortlake home would burn to the ground and that Dee's wife Jane would die horribly. Back in Mortlake, around the same time, a group of scholars broke into Dee's house. They didn't burn it down, but they did ransack his library taking hundreds of his most treasured books and other possessions. It didn't bode well for Jane. But Kelly also delivered to Dee what he described as the Kabbalah of nature, a long stream of so-called divine data. Dee was ecstatic. It felt as though they were only months away from discovering God's own blueprint for the universe. Day after day, the travellers' temporary lodging rooms were filled with the feverish scratchings of Dee's quill, racing to record Kelly's supposed transmissions. Dee would then spend more long hours collating them with his notes from previous seances in an attempt to assemble what he now saw as an apparent cosmic code that was coming from the Garden of Eden and written in the language of Adam, just one remove from God himself. After 5 grueling months of travel, encountering floods, blizzards and storms along the way, Dee's party arrived in Krakow, the then capital city of Poland. All the while, Kelly continued to pour forth alleged angelic formulas. But then, in mid-April, Kelly announced he would cease communicating with the angels altogether. He became suddenly despondent and even discredited some of his own visions, claiming that malicious spirits were playing tricks on him. One night, while scrying with Kelly and Prince Lasky, Dee received angelic instructions that he should go and see the Holy Roman Emperor, Rudolf II, in Prague. But Dee was reluctant. All around him in Poland, violence had erupted in the streets when Polish military commander Samuel Sporowski, a popular member of the Polish nobility and affiliate of Prince Lasky's, was executed. Borowski had been accused of plotting to kill the King of Poland, Stefan Batory. Dee was beginning to wonder if his own association with Prince Lasky, who had ambitions to take the throne, put him and his family's lives in danger. Then Dee's son Roland fell gravely ill and almost died. A few days later, as Dee and Kelly conducted another seance, Kelly claimed to receive an angry message from the angels. They said that Dee's son's illness was a punishment for not heeding their original command. And so on the 1st of August 1584, Dee and Kelly set out for Prague. On arrival in Prague, the capital of what was then Bohemia and the larger Holy Roman Empire, its medieval streets intrigued Dee and Kelly. It was a city bursting with classic Bohemian charm, the buildings covered with mysterious stone carvings, their walls painted with strange dioramas, taverns with names like the Unicorn, the Blue Star and the Vulture lined the endless labyrinthine alleyways. They soon found lodgings with Emperor Rudolf's physician, Thaddeus Hayek, who also happened to be Central Europe's foremost astronomer. Dee hit it off with Hayek immediately, who invited him and Kelly to use his study to continue their scrying. Those seances produced a series of intense apocalyptic visions. The spirit Medimi appeared once more, with another dire warning for Dee. Satan himself was intent on destroying him and his family if they didn't relocate to Prague immediately. She also told him that he must tell the Holy Roman Emperor, Rudolf II, that an angel of the Lord had rebuked him for his sins. Doing such a thing would risk the wrath and outrage of one of the most powerful people in the world, but with the recent near-fatal illness of his son still fresh in his mind, Dee felt he had no choice but to oblige, or else risk further retribution from the angels. And so, after some carefully worded letters, Dee secured an audience with the Emperor. after being met by his chamberlain, a nervous and trembling Dee was led through the twists and turns of the Emperor's elaborate palace. Much like Kublai Khan's stately pleasure dome, it was a place of wonders, full of curiosities, including narwhal bones, a mandrake root in the shape of a man, the dried remains of a dragon, along with works of fine art and an extensive library. The Emperor even had an African lion that he kept outside, whose roars echoed across the palace precincts all day long. Finally, Dee was led into the Emperor's inner sanctum, where he found Rudolph waiting for him. Taking a deep breath, he delivered the unpalatable message just as the angels had demanded. "My grace, the angel of the Lord hath appeared to me and rebuked you for your sins," he said. "If you will forsake your wickedness and turn into him, your seat shall be the greatest that ever was." The entire court was stunned by his impertinence. The Emperor stared at Dee in silence as Dee's forehead began to bead with sweat. Rudolph was a stout man who looked even larger in his padded doublet and pantaloons. Though Dee didn't know this, it was said that he had a succession of mistresses, several illegitimate children, affairs with his head butler, and several of his valets. Perhaps it was all that played on his mind during those endless seconds of silence, for rather than get angry, he agreed that on balance the rebuke was probably deserved and that atonement was needed. Dee was enthusiastically accepted into the Emperor's court circle, and the Emperor offered to do whatever he could to support him financially. After a few months in Prague, Dee and Kelly returned to Krakow, where they resumed their seances with the angels. Germanico Malaspina, an ambassador for the Pope, arrived in the city about the same time. Malaspina saw Dee and Kelly at best as inconvenient foreigners, but at worst, a dangerous influence on the Holy Roman Emperor's court. In May 1585, Dee learned that Malaspina had presented Emperor Rudolph with evidence that Dee had been involved in necromancy and other prohibited arts. The following day, Dee received a decree. He'd been banished by Rudolph from all of Bohemia. Luckily, the banishment didn't last long. After 4 months holed up in Germany, Dee and Kelly were permitted to return to Bohemia, after which they were invited to stay at Trebon Castle, 100 miles south of Prague, home of Wilhelm Rosenberg, Bohemia's most powerful and wealthy nobleman, and one of Europe's most enthusiastic patrons of alchemical research. The Renaissance-style castle boasted tall white walls, numerous towers and turrets, and sat in the middle of lush meadows and fish ponds, and from the back of it, thick plumes of black smoke rose up into the air, coming from several silver mines that Rosenberg had opened after vast quantities of the precious metal were discovered on his land. The mines were making Rosenberg rich, but he wanted more. With the help of John Dee, Edward Kelly, and the supposed angels, Rosenberg embarked on a systematic alchemical quest to turn base metals into gold. Rosenberg built a laboratory for the two men, who spent the next few years pursuing this quest. For months, Dee and Kelly worked together, experimenting with all manner of formulations involving combinations of salts, rare earths, horse manure, and even menstrual blood. At some point, Kelly revealed to Dee that with the help of the angels, he'd finally cracked the secret of the Philosopher's Stone. He called Dee over to his station so he could witness it for himself. Dee watched as Kelly took a small pinch of an unidentified red powder, supposedly a portion of the Philosopher's Stone, then dropped it into a crucible containing 1¼ ounces of mercury. Dee watched wide-eyed as the elements began to melt and fuse together, until a dull yellow substance began to form, liquid gold. From that day forward, everything had changed. Rumours of Kelly's alchemical prowess spread fast. By the time this story had reached the English court, it was said that 1 ounce of Kelly's magic powder could produce almost 280,000 ounces of gold. Edward Kelly acted fast on capitalizing on his apparent alchemical skills. His wealth and fame began to grow, while his reliance on John Dee began to diminish. In early 1587, Kelly told Dee that he'd received word from the angels that his scrying powers were no longer needed, and that they'd pass them on to Dee's 7-year-old son Arthur instead. A little confused by the sudden turn of events, Dee nonetheless persevered with Arthur, but after 2 weeks, it was clear that his young son hadn't been endowed with any kind of supernatural talent at all. Dee pleaded for Kelly to return, much to his delight. 2 weeks later, he did. It was only a few days after that that Dee and Kelly were once more gathered around a crystal ball under candlelight. After a series of incantations, Kelly claimed to see the young child figure of Madimi appear again in the glass. The girl was wearing a cloak, he said, and she was pulling it to one side, revealing a naked body underneath. Then she began to speak. Dee hurriedly wrote it down as Kelly relayed her message. "He who commits adultery because of me, let him be blessed for eternity and receive the heavenly prize." Kelly appeared repulsed by the instruction, and what had it meant exactly anyway? Adultery with whom? Dee and Kelly agreed to forget it, but as the seances continued, the supposed Madimi continued to deliver the same message in varying formats. In a later session, Kelly claimed to see the heads of himself and his wife Joanna, and Dee and his wife Jane, on some kind of pillar, while Madimi performed a ceremony involving the grafting of tree branches together. He told Dee that this indicated that the four of them were to be similarly united. Dee nodded cautiously. Perhaps, he wondered, it meant they were to be united in a godly Christian sense. But Kelly was adamant. Madimi was in fact suggesting that they have sex with each other's wives. With his complete trust in Edward Kelly and the words of the angels, John Dee relayed this latest instruction to his wife. Jane was utterly appalled and flat out refused, believing that something must have been lost in translation. Later that night, while Dee and Kelly conducted another seance, Kelly once again made contact with Madimi. His mouth dropped in horror. "What is it?" asked Dee. Kelly turned to Dee and explained somberly that Madimi had just informed him that both England and Queen Elizabeth would be destroyed, and that Dee would be pursued by the Catholic Church for heresy if they didn't carry out the adulterous ceremony as instructed. It was sometime around 2 in the morning when John Dee broke the news to Jane. Jane shook uncontrollably and wept loudly, berating her husband for his unconscionable demand. Meanwhile, in Kelly's bedchamber, his wife Joanna was similarly outraged. Kelly had married Joanna Cooper during the early days of his tenure in Dee's Mortlake house around the spring of 1583. There was speculation that Kelly had been paid to marry her to legitimise her two children, which had been born out of wedlock as the result of an affair with an aristocrat. Joanna was repulsed by what was being asked of her. In the early hours of that morning, Jane did as she was asked, turning to Dee before leaving her bedroom to say, "I trust that God will absolve me of any shame or inconvenience." And so Jane and Kelly, along with Dee and Joanna, had sex in their separate chambers. A few days later, Kelly and Dee summoned the spirits once more. This time, according to Kelly, a number of figures appeared on horseback. Kelly said that one of the figures wanted confirmation that he had indeed slept with Dee's wife as requested. "Was thy brother's wife obedient and humble to thee?" they asked. Kelly turned to Dee. "Yes, yes, she was." This would be the last recorded scrying session that Dee and Kelly would ever conduct. Unsurprisingly, a rift developed between the two men, which only deepened when, 9 months later, Jane gave birth to a baby boy. Dee raised the son as his own, and never once mentioned the child's paternity in his writings, though many suspect the boy was not his. In February 1589, the pair agreed to part ways. Without Kelly, Dee's search for the truths of the universe ground to an immediate halt. A distraught Dee and his family left Bohemia and returned to England, arriving back at Mortlake in November of that year. It was a sad homecoming. Dee arrived to find his house in disarray, with many of his most cherished possessions, from books to precious artifacts, stolen. In the meantime, Edward Kelly made his way to Prague. Within a year, capitalizing on his alleged ability to transmute base metals into gold, he acquired lands with a castle and 9 villages, as well as 2 houses in Prague, and became a baron in the process. He even reputedly turned part of a bedpan into gold as a present for Queen Elizabeth I. Anxious to secure Kelly's apparent talents for the English crown, the Queen's key advisor, William Cecil, implored him to return to England with promises of money and lands as a lure, but Kelly declined the offer. By May 1591, doubts were starting to circulate about the veracity of Kelly's self-proclaimed abilities. At the end of April, Bohemia's Secretary of State called at Kelly's house in Prague to arrest him, but Kelly, having seen him coming, climbed out of a back window and escaped. The Emperor Rudolf was incensed and sent out troops to apprehend him. He was eventually captured and imprisoned, before being released in the autumn of 1593. Back in England, Dee once again petitioned Queen Elizabeth for a role in her court. Much to his relief, she offered him one, but only if it was approved by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the head of the Church of England. Given Dee's sinister reputation for dabbling in the occult, the Archbishop refused. Instead, keen to get Dee away from London and the Queen, the Archbishop set him up with a job in Manchester, where he was installed as the warden or head of Christ College Church, known today as Manchester Cathedral. Dee was not a good fit for Christ's College, jarring immediately with the faculty, who took a dim view of his occult practices. However, this didn't stop several priests asking Dee for his help when, in early 1595, a report was received regarding the unusual behaviour of two children near Tyldesley in Lancashire. The children were thought to be possessed. A man called Edmund Hartley, who some believed was a witch, was asked to assist with the matter. With the use of some herbs and Catholic charms, Hartley had apparently cured the children, only for their strange affliction to return again soon after. When the children's father, a wealthy landowner, asked Hartley to intervene again, Hartley asked for more money and some land in return, but the father refused. When the children's condition worsened soon after, Hartley was accused of somehow being responsible. Now, as a representative of the Church of England, who were trying to suppress exorcists, John Dee wisely declined the offer to get involved. Hartley was accused of being a conjurer and executed. You can learn more about this story in Unexplained, Season 5, Episode 14, The Devil's Kiss. Over the next few years, Dee became increasingly miserable. The world was changing once more and fast leaving him behind. A new age was dawning as the English crown sought to expand its reach, first through colonizing Ireland and then with the establishing of its first colony in the New World on the island of Roanoke. With the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588, England's global power and influence would be assured for centuries to come. And though Dee, with his predictions and assurances to Queen Elizabeth, not to mention his genuine talent for maths and cartography, had in some ways contributed to all that, it was clear he was no longer needed. Not only that, many of the old guard, including his friends and supporters, were dead or soon to die. And in 1603, perhaps his most fervent, Queen Elizabeth I, also died. It isn't known exactly what happened to Edward Kelly in the last few years of his life. Some said he found renewed favour with Emperor Rudolf in Bohemia. Others that he fought against the Ottoman Empire for Wilhelm Rosenberg's brother. Another story was that Kelly was imprisoned again after a dispute with an influential alchemist, having then apparently attempted to escape his cell by tying bedsheets together. He fell from a great height, breaking both his legs. No one is sure when or how Kelly eventually died, only that the last reliable report of him alive was in 1598, living somewhere in what is now the Czech Republic. While Polish prince Olbracht Laski never did become King of Poland. In 1605, John Dee was still in Manchester when the city was hit by the plague. As apparently foretold by the angels all those years before, Dee's wife Jane and several of their children were infected and died horribly. Soon after, Dee and his surviving children returned to his home at Mortlake on the River Thames, where he spent his final years in relative obscurity. In March 1607, nearly 10 years since his last sessions with Edward Kelly, Dee made one final attempt to recapture some of the angelic visions of old and finally learn the knowledge he'd spent most of his life searching for. He used his former servant Bartholomew Hickman as a scryer, but the visions they obtained were only pale imitations of what Dee had once experienced. However, the angel Raphael did apparently reassure Dee that he would soon finally achieve a perfect understanding of God's hidden knowledge. A few years later, At the age of 81, John Dee died. Perhaps only then did he finally find what he was looking for. John Dee was buried beneath the chancel in the Church of St. Mary the Virgin at Mortlake. The headstone is long gone, but in 2013, a memorial plaque was installed inside the church. It reads, "Near this place lie the remains of John Dee, clerk in holy orders, astronomer, geographer, mathematician, and advisor to Queen Elizabeth I. There is no mention of magic, alchemy, and astrology, or all his years spent trying, as some believe with some success, to commune with angels. There are unsubstantiated rumours that towards the end of his life, Dee put some of his most precious books and notes of angelic code in a chest and buried it in his garden in the hope that they might one day be discovered and finally decoded. Some say these books were found, others that they have long been lost to time, and some say they never existed at all. However, many of Dee's treasured books, astrological charts, and perhaps more intriguingly, recordings of the apparent Enochian language of the angels can still be found to this day in places such as the British Library and the Royal College of Physicians in London. A number of his artifacts, including a crystal ball and an obsidian scrying mirror with which he and Edward Kelly are said to have once communicated with angels and spirits, can also be found at the British Museum. This episode was written by Diane Hope and Richard McLean Smith. Unexplained is an AV Club Productions podcast created by Richard McLean Smith. All other elements of the podcast, including the music, are also produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, with stories never before featured on the show, is now available to buy worldwide. You can purchase from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, and other bookstores. Please subscribe to and rate the show wherever you get your podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can find out more at unexplainedpodcast.com and reach us online through Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.